Will Naomi have an heir? That's one of the questions. Remember, I said the story is really about Naomi. It's really about her. Ruth just got her name on it. Then the other thing is, who's going to marry Ruth? We don't know. Is Boaz going to marry, or is this other guardian redeemer going to do it? Will Ruth's good reputation work against her? I mean, Boaz thinks she's got a good reputation, but the other guy might too, and that might work to spoil the situation here. Will Boaz acquiesce Ruth to the fellow man? Is he going to fight for her or say, well, that's the way it is? So unlike the previous chapter, which is this private conversation between a man and woman at night, this one features a legal proceeding. It's all public. It's these different scenes that the author draws. They're very unique. They're very different. They're very distinct. And suddenly we have this one in broad daylight, very public, very legal, compared to the private matter the night before. Now, the legal proceeding, note, is not judicial. There's no judges there trying to verify that the right and wrong is happening. It's just administrative. It's a family or a clan matter. So the two men involved will discuss the matter, and once a decision is agreed upon, the extended family, all the people around it, they just say, okay, you know, that's right. It happened the right way, and they witness it. That's what it's all about. They're not there to make a judgment on whether or not it's legal. However, they would be there in the future to say, yes, we saw it happen, we were witnesses to it, it was all fine and good then. So, Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. So all it is it goes right to the gate. Everybody who's going to go to work that day on the fields is going to go through that gate. Everything happens at the gate. That's what's important to understand. That's the best place to get everybody. The best place to gather the crowd, because they all had to go through there. The gate was the place where all legal things happened in the ancient world. The gate, the city gate, the elders at the gate. You read this all the way through the Old Testament. And it was also the place in the city that had the most area for a public gathering. There'd be the gate, and there'd be shops around there, and that would be the only real opening. Once you got into the city itself, I mean, people were crammed in there, houses and little walkways, and if you wanted to have something, you just did it there. So he sat down. It says, just as he sat down, how convenient, the other guy arrived. So the author is trying to show you how the timing is just so convenient for everything here. He called the man over, then they sat down together. The man acts without hesitation. So you get the impression this is just normal life, not anything unique. You know, you're just saying, hey, can you come over here? And it would be, you know, regularly. If there was any legal thing to be solved or anything to be done, people would just come by and do it. In fact, the word there is to uncover the ear. You read about that in the Old Testament, have the ear uncovered. And, you know, imagine, people don't have haircuts like I do. They got longer hair. So when you uncover somebody's ears, the idea is you're pushing the hair back and talking in their ear. Really the idea that goes along with it. The other man in the story is not named, which it's one of those things you can make speculation about, but you don't have to. But it's interesting that it isn't, but it's also it's hard to say why. The Hebrew, in fact, calls him Mr. So-and-so. Mr. So-and-so. And you see that used throughout the Old Testament at time. You know, you'll see this guy, you know, and go to him. This Mr. So-and-so. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the Hebrew totally correctly. But we say Mr. So-and-so in our language. The Hebrew would say this, Peloni Almoni. So it also has that rhythm to it. And that would be the typical thing. If you didn't want to name somebody, you just want to say Mr. So-and-so, you'd say Peloni Almoni. Now, we don't know why it's written this way, without him and another name there. The author could have used other things. So when Boaz addresses him, he could have said, my kinsman. You know, the author could leave him nameless, but say something other than Mr. So-and-so. So perhaps the author wants to keep the other man anonymous for reasons of embarrassment. Just to, you know, there's no need to spoil his name by bringing him down or whatever. We don't know. Maybe it is a judgment by the author. Maybe I'll leave him nameless in the story as a punishment for what he did. We just don't know. See how you can go either way with it? That's why you can't, when you can go either way with your theories, it's better just to not take a strong stand on anything there. It's just this guy. He's nameless, maybe because he didn't act to preserve the name of one of his kinsmen. You didn't act to preserve the name of Elimelech, so we won't preserve your name in the story. And possibly that's what's going on here. Well, Boaz gets these 10 elders. They're passing by as well. And they would have been people who would have been there for making legal decisions. They would have obtained a great deal of wisdom over the years. Think about that, too. You know, you don't have all these written records. We have all these written records. We're very dependent upon it. They wouldn't have had that. You know, in the small little town there that they had, the wisdom of the elders that you read about in the Old Testament, it's really important. They were the ones, they've heard all the legal decisions over the years, and they had a memory of it. So when you went and said, now, we got this disagreement about something that happened 20 years ago. Now you've got these other guys that maybe have been around listening to the stories and witnesses and stuff for all that period of time, and they contribute to making decisions on the past. But these people, they'd know the history of the city, the occupants. They'd know all the conflicts over the years, who got into it with so-and-so over the years, and everything. They would have been involved in all the resolutions. It's kind of interesting when you think of a city that would be run just by the memories of people. Because we don't operate that way. We don't even think about trying to operate that way. Because it's so difficult, for just even a typical family. Remember when two of your kids come, so-and-so did such-and-such to me. Well, what really happened? And then you get two sides of the story. Both are wrong. You know, it's so hard to do that. Now, 10 men are selected. That might have been what a quorum was. We know that later on in the synagogues, 10 men are necessary. 10 might just be a round number that indicates more. Sometimes when you see round numbers in the Old Testament, it just means it's a round number. It could be more. It could be less. It doesn't really matter. That's not the point. 10 was a number of completeness, so it could just very well have been literally 10, or it could have been more. It doesn't matter. The narrator's point in including all these details is to indicate that the outcome of this is legal and binding. Nobody later on can challenge it. That's why it's very important. There's these technical little bits, and when you get into Boaz's speech, you think, wow, he's being very particular with his language. He is, because everything has to be right. Now, Boaz offers the man the right to the property. It says this, Boaz said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of these sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. Then the man says, I will redeem it. So he says, gives them the offer, gives them the details. We've got the situation. It needs to be attended to. You get first choice, but if you don't want it, I'll take it. And the man says, oh, I'll take it. Now imagine the scene. 12 men begin this legal process. There's, you know, the Boaz and the other redeemer, and then the 10. But as you can also imagine, it's right at the city gate. Everybody passing by. I mean, some people go, oh, that's another thing, doesn't involve me, and go to work. But people are going to stop. You're going to get witnesses. You know, what's going on? You know, the busybody factor. You just can't get away from it. And that would happen. So imagine the curious people begin to stop. You know, it's going to gather a crowd to be there. Boaz doesn't start with Ruth, but he starts with the property, because that's the real legal issue here. Remember, I've tried to tell you over the last few weeks that this isn't a Levirate marriage where the brother is obligated to marry. There's not that obligation in this case. Okay, but there is an obligation to the land. That's the first thing. That's the real legal issue here. And that needed to be decided. It's the first obligation. Naomi has returned from Moab. She's selling the land of Elimelech. There's no heir there. The land has to go to somebody. It has to be reabsorbed into the clan some way, shape, or form. So the right to the land is the question of the day. The property would undoubtedly come with the need to care for Naomi. That's also obvious. She's an old widow. She needs to be cared for. There's nobody else to care for. When she sells the land, part of the the value of the land is to go to caring for her and taking care of her. That wasn't even part of the decision. That was all taken for granted. No surprise there. But Boaz seems to be keeping Ruth kind of out of the matter right now, because he doesn't throw her into the first question. He leaves her aside. If the man will decide the way Boaz wants, he says, you can have it. Why even bring Ruth up? You know, just leave her out of it and settle that later. But if the man does want the field, then Boaz has to play the card, the Ruth card, into the equation, which he's obviously holding back. Boaz makes it clear that the man is first in line. Boaz is second. He's also making it clear that he wants it. He's saying, I will take the land if you don't want it. So if you pass it by, it's not like it's going to, you know, we won't know what to do with it. I will take it. So that's one thing he wants the guy to know. What effect will this have on the other guy? Well, it might make him competitive. You know, part of it is, well, if he's, why does he want it so badly? You know, maybe there's something good there. It might cause the other man to be more willing to pass it by. You know, if he can't handle the responsibility of the land, he knows that it's going to stay in the clan, it's going to be taken care of, Naomi would be taken care of. Again, it's one of those things where we don't even know how the effect could be. So you can't attribute any kind of motive to people. Anyway, ultimately, Naomi's going to be cared for. The land is going to stay in the close family. So it'd be more of an assurance to the man that it's okay if he says no. And I think that's probably more the leaning. It's okay to say no, because I'll take care of it if you can't. So it's a reassurance to the man. That's probably the better way to think of it. The other man he can't go wrong with the transaction. If he takes the land, he's a hero. He's fulfilling the family obligations. He's doing his duty. He's getting the field at a good price. Naomi could not produce an heir at her age, so the land is going to pass to his own kids, right? So if Naomi can't produce an heir, that land that he's buying, even though he's going to take care of Naomi to her death, he absorbs that land for his own kids. That's going to pass on. So he's enlarging his own estate. That's a good deal. So how can he go wrong? Well, he really can't. Of course, if he says yes, the romance part of the story is over. The legal issues then become the focus of the story. So you don't get to the end of the story and you go, and the moral of the story is legal obligations are more important, and you do those things and everything turns out in the end, one way or another. But that's not what the author, what a boring story, right? The author didn't want to leave it that way. Boaz introduces Ruth into the transaction. Since the man is willing to buy the field, he's got to play the Ruth card. Boaz says, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Bummer. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. The man backs away. So we want to try to find out why. Obviously, it's more interesting that way. He tells the man that if he gets the property, he also gets the widow Ruth, and along with her, the obligation to carry on the dead man's name. He will have to provide Naomi and Ruth, but he has to provide an heir who will get the land. You see, the land won't go to you ultimately. It will revert. It will still be your child, all right? But it'll be a separate estate in the end. Either way, Boaz's promise to Ruth is going to be resolved. She's going to marry one of the two guys, right? Naomi's going to have the potential. Note, it's potential at this point for an heir. So we have to understand how important a name was in ancient Israel. I've talked many times over the year the value of a name, how important it is in the people of Israel. And it becomes important in this part of the story here as well. To have an heir meant that your name went on living with the ancestral land. This land belongs to so-and-so, the father of so-and-so, the father. You know, and they have that. Elimelech, if he dies without an heir, ultimately, his name dies. He becomes cut off. He becomes annihilated. That's a serious thing for the people. No, he has no one to remember his name. He is forgotten. And certainly we suspect Boaz is hoping that the additional information about Ruth will persuade the other man to pass the right of redemption on to Boaz. I'm going to come back to Naomi in a minute. Well, it'll be a few minutes. So we have to note this language. He's not saying, let me read what his response is again, just so you hear it fresh. I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take the right of redemption for yourself. I cannot redeem it. He's not claiming that he's unwilling. All right? He's saying that if he does it, he will endanger his own estate. And there's a very, very important distinction in that. If he just says, oh, I'm not doing that, he'll bring shame upon himself, right? But if he's got a legitimate reason, I'd love to do it, but I can't. You see, we can't say anything negative against the guy. He's willing to do it. He's wanting to do it. It just doesn't work out today. And really, that's what he's claiming. But how would his own estate be endangered? Well, he would have to use his own money to buy the land, okay, and support Naomi out of that. Then he's going to have to care for Naomi and Ruth. Now, certainly the land's going to produce some value, so that shouldn't be a problem. He's also going to have to care for any and all children Ruth has. Then he's eventually going to have to give the field away to the children of Ruth. Now, the other thing is, if the guy's already married, he's saying it's his own estate. He's already married. He already has his own kids. He's worried about how that's going to, he's going to be taking a huge chunk of money to purchase the land that he never gets back. Okay? That's his biggest concern. Now, the other issue, if he's already married and has his own kids, then he'd have to have more than one wife. And polygamy was permissible, but probably rare, because it was expensive. And it was full of conflict. It was difficult. And ultimately, this man knew that his own finances couldn't bear the strain. So he was going to pass on. So again, one of the contrasts that I've been trying to point out in this book, you see the difference between the people that say, you know, I've examined the things and wisdom dictates that I go this way. All right? That's what happened at the beginning of the story with the other daughter-in-law. It didn't make sense to go back to Bethlehem. So she stayed behind. All the way through the story, you have the people who do what makes sense, and then people like Ruth and Boaz. Here, the guy, you can't condemn him because he's doing what's best. But it's always contrasted by the person who acts in faith, the person who acts in self-sacrifice. See, it's sacrificial love all the way through the story. That's the idea that's being hammered home, that God works through that. Note, the author never condemns the people who do what's ordinary. That's another thing I've said. He never condemns it. When the other daughter-in-law goes back, he never says anything bad about her. Later, Jewish tradition does, but the author doesn't. This guy here that we don't know the name, the author doesn't say anything bad about him. He's doing what he thinks is best, and there's no reason to condemn him. That's okay. He's highlighting the difference between that, that God works through the other, too. He works through this sacrificial love. The other people aren't denigrated by their choices. It may be possible the man recognized also that Boaz obviously wanted to marry Ruth. And we have to give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he said, you know, this guy's starstruck here. I'm not taking that away from him. You know, you see, when you get into the details, you can't make these snap judgments about people. We don't know what all's going on. Boaz was very wanting, he was saying, I want to buy the land. And then this other detail about the Moabites that the other guy didn't know about, or maybe he did, but he didn't think he'd have to marry her. He can tell Boaz wants her. Maybe he just would have said, I can pass on this. Because their happiness is more important than my getting the land. You see, it's possible. It's always possible when you look at some of these stories to take away a different view of people. Anyway, now the reader gets this chance to relax. Okay, Boaz is going to marry Ruth. It's all going to have this happy ending. So then we get into the technical details of the transaction, which are very interesting. Now, this was the custom in former times. It's interesting, the author writes that. You think, so when the author writes this, whatever he's about to describe wasn't normal anymore. It had already changed enough that he says, well, this is the way it used to be done. which is fascinating. Because when the story's written, you know, how much time has passed? Some, you know, 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, 500 years. We don't know the timing. This was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You're witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are my witnesses this day." So again, very technical legal language. Repetition of all the details and all the facts. It's very important for the author to make sure it comes across. There's no question about the legality of any of this. So let's talk about the sandal ceremony. It's different than the one you see in the law. If you go back to the law, you see a ceremony that's given there for Levirate marriage, okay, when you're required to marry the widow of your brother. In that case, the sandal is given to the widow, and she spits in the man's face and says, "This is what happens." You know, this story is not, they're not connected. And we don't even know, you know, the timing of the different traditions. It's not the same thing. That's why there's no spitting in the face or anything. But we don't see that here. And so some people look at the stones, well, they didn't follow the law. Because they weren't doing the same thing. So it's important to see these technical details. It's not the same issue at all. Different context there. Here, there's something else. The author has to explain it to his readers. So it's obviously something they're not even familiar with. There's been a change in things over the years. Now, presumably, the man is transferring his right symbolically to what? The land. Remember, it has nothing to do with marrying the widow initially. It's about land. So what does that mean? Why take off your sandal and give it to the other guy? Well, it's because, and this is most likely, it has to do with ownership of land. Land is where you put your feet. All right? So we know in other nations around there, the Nuzi tradition, an older one, demonstrated land sales like this. We'd both go to the property, right? And I would lift my foot off it, and you would set your foot on it. And that's what the way we would show. I no longer possess this land. You do. Your feet are on this. Where else do you see that kind of symbolism used in the Old Testament? Everywhere you go, wherever your foot treads, I will give that land to you. You see that? You have that language throughout the whole rest of the earlier patriarchs and even the taking the land under Joshua. It's very, very significant. See, where your feet go, that's the land you own. So to remove the sandal then, without going out to the field, it's symbolic of this earlier tradition. That's most likely what's involved there. Think of another case. Moses in front of the burning bush. Moses, take off your sandals. Why? Because I own this land. Your sandals don't go on this land. You're not a sandal wearer here. I am, because I own the land. You come in here, you have to go barefoot because you're not the owner of the land. So you see that also possible symbolism used there as well. I think it's very likely that's another angle on the story that I never knew before with the burning bush and the feet in the holy ground. But it certainly makes some sense. So here, it's probably demonstrating that the man relinquishes his right to the land by being barefoot and giving that right, represented by his sandal, to Boaz. Boaz gives a very detailed account of the transaction. He wants all the legal points mentioned so that no one can challenge him later. Furthermore, he calls everyone present to witness what transpires that day. Not just the 10 men he selected, but all the witnesses around him are called to participate. You've all seen it done here, basically, is what he's saying to them. What's interesting to me, that legal transactions, I said, they're not done on paper. They're done in the memory of the community. The memory of the community would remember a land transaction or who owned what or how long. And they could only last up until the year of Jubilees. The length of time any one of these transactions could ever last would be 70 years. which is within lifetimes of people who would be around, able to witness it. Another thing that's interesting to me here, remember in the story of Jeremiah, Jeremiah's going, you know, it's after the first people have been hauled off, but Jeremiah is left in the land with some remaining people, the poor of the land, and more people will be hauled off. And Jeremiah is told to go purchase a field in order to guarantee, you know, as a God, we will return here. And as a sign of that, God tells him to buy the land. But when they purchased that land, it was different. They wrote it on a piece of paper. He put it in a jar and he buried it. What else is part of that imagery there? That when you think about the ownership of the land and things done in the memory of people, the other thing you see, not just the fact that, you know, we'll come back to this land, it's like all the witnesses are going to be gone from this land. So there's that other angle to the story in Jeremiah that there won't be anybody sitting around in 70 years saying this land Jeremiah bought. They're gone. Jeremiah needs that piece of paper. Ruth now is a full member of the community. So one of the ideas I talked about before, she starts as a foreigner in her own land. She comes back, then she's a foreigner in the land of Israel. Then she's this less than one of Boaz's servants. Then she's working with the servant girls. And she moves her way through all these connections to finally become the wife of Boaz. She's moved through all these different circles. Now she's truly part of the community. She's restored and she finds rest. That was one of the things that in chapter 1. May you find rest. A very important thing, which means to be at peace in a family. Elimelech's name is also saved at this point in the story. Then the crowd offers their blessing on the people here. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders, see the separation, the people at the gate and the elders, the witnesses and the elders, they said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who has come into your house," okay, Ruth, "make her like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." Now, those are the wives of Jacob, who's also known as Israel. "May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." They offer this blessing, and it's interesting you go through it. They're blessing Ruth as a wife, not as a foreigner. She's part of the community, and they recognize her. And they say, may she be like Leah and Rachel. May she be like the founding mothers of Israel. Without Rachel and Leah, there would be no Israel. They bless Boaz. That's the second person in there. May he have standing. May he have fame in the community. May he be wealthy. May he have lots of kids. These are the ideas and the words they use there. And then they bless the offspring, you know, the kids that they're going to have. May the family name be like Perez, that Tamar bore to Judah. Now, I mentioned, I think it was last week, these connections that the author wants you to have between Ruth and Boaz and the patriarchs, people like Abraham and Sarah. And in this case, and I mentioned it last week, Tamar and Judah. And now you see him actually use the words here. Very, very significant. Tamar is the tribal mother of Judah, essentially, by default, because that's the strongest, most prominent one of the tribes of Judah. That's just what happened. By the way, if you go back and you try to understand who Tamar is, she's probably a Canaanite. She's not part of the original family of Abraham. She's a foreigner, too. So when you get to the New Testament, there's only four women who are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. Tamar, okay, a Canaanite, most likely, foreigner. Ruth, Moabitess, foreigner. Rahab, Canaanite, foreigner. And, oh, shoot. Are we at Mary? Yeah, the danger of getting off my notes. But do you see these prominent, important women, but they're not Jews. They're Canaanites, Moabites. It didn't matter. God doesn't care. People invent a lot of stuff. She's also, the other thing, if you go back and study the story, it's in Genesis 38. She also sought to keep a family name from extinction. Her case was one of the Levirate marriages. Her husband died, and she was saying, I need to marry the brother. And Judah wasn't fulfilling that responsibility to her. And for some unknown reason, ultimately, her son, Perez, is the one who has the clan that dominates in Judah. It becomes the dominant tribe of all that's left in Israel, is Tamar. So if you study the people, you know, have the 10 tribes gone away, and then you got a few Benjamites, and then a whole bunch of Jews, but most of those Jews are from Perez, which are from Tamar, the Canaanite woman. It's fascinating to see that. It's also one of the reasons the story's actually included in Genesis. So the blessing shifts from the emphasis in the story from providing an heir for Elimelech, which was an important aspect, but now it moves to the new line that Boaz and Ruth are founding. May that new line you start be like the line of Perez. That's the blessing that they're saying here. They're asking Yahweh to bless the union with children. Now remember, Ruth never had children by her first husband. So it's unknown at this point. She might be sterile. We don't know yet. Until you get later in the story. And that's how the author wants to finish it off. Now, here's what the next section I've titled, Naomi has a son. Naomi has a son. Not Ruth has a son. Naomi does. Because watch, we will read this here. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, not to Ruth here, blessed be the Lord, Yahweh, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him. The happiness of this section is in contrast to chapter 1. Remember chapter 1? Everybody dies. She comes back. I'm empty. Don't call me pleasantness. Call me bitter. Because God hates me. Or God is against me. That's what she said. So in chapter 1, we see famine, death, emptiness, sorrow. And here we have life and richness and fullness. It's this total contrast. So Boaz takes Ruth home. It's important in this part, too. Remember at the end of chapter 2? What did we read at the end of chapter 2? And Ruth lived with her mother-in-law. And here we have, and Ruth went to live with Boaz. So now she moves to a new household. She's found rest. She conceives a son, and that's attributed to Yahweh, to the Lord. Although technically Ruth will have a new mother-in-law, Boaz's mother, if she's still alive, Naomi still called her mother-in-law. Because they don't, that connection, that family connection, it's important to understand, that's not severed. It doesn't change. It's a family relationship like the one of Melchizedek in the New Testament. It lasts forever. There's no way for it to stop. She can't get a divorce from her husband. I mean, there's no way for that to end. She will forever be Naomi's daughter-in-law. And then poof, like 9 months go by, one sentence. That's not part of the story. We don't really care. We just want to get to having the child. The women hear Naomi's cry in chapter 1 when she returns about how empty she is. And now they're the ones who come to her and say, there's a son. They also might be the ones who are bringing the news of the birth to Naomi. It's kind of ambiguous and why she wouldn't know and stuff, but it sounds like the way it's written is they bring the news to Naomi and tell her what has occurred. And they say, they relate that Ruth is the one who loves Naomi. Ruth loves you. She's better than 7 sons. Now, that's pretty high praise because having a son was far better than having a daughter in ancient Israel. And to have 7, which is the ideal number, she's better than 7 sons? That's saying something really high for Ruth. In other words, if a person had 1 Ruth, they had a better chance of survival than having 7 sons. That's what they're saying. Because really that was the question in the whole story. Would Naomi die of starvation? Would anybody care for her in her old age? Would she have an heir? And what they're saying is having seven sons wouldn't be better than having one Ruth. Ruth did a better job than seven sons would. Where the blessing for Boaz was in Judah, they, you know, in Bethlehem and Ephrathah, the blessing for the child's name is given for all Israel. Let me read that. This is important. I'm going to read it again. Blessed be Yahweh who has not left you this day without a redeemer. Now, listen carefully to who is being mentioned here. Blessed be Yahweh who has left you this day without a redeemer, that his name be renowned in Israel. There's a surprise here, because they're not talking about Boaz. All the way through the story, the focus has been on Boaz as the redeemer, but you get here, and these people say the child is the redeemer. It's a twist we weren't expecting. It's a twist. And may his name be for all Israel. The witnesses earlier said, may Boaz's name be great in Ephrathah and Bethlehem. But these women say, may the child be great in all Israel. They're stepping it up a notch. The child here is called guardian redeemer. The child is the one who takes away the disgrace. The child is the one who takes care of Naomi in her old age. The child is the one who continues the family name. The child is the one who preserves the inheritance of the land, not Boaz. Fascinating. Verse 16, then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. Nurse is poor translation. Foster mother is probably better. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name saying, a son has been born to Naomi. A son has been born to Naomi, not Ruth, to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So Naomi takes this child. And getting back to that surprise, Naomi's the parent. Naomi becomes the parent of this child. The Hebrew word there, cared for him, means to be a foster parent, a parent in the absence of the natural parents. So not only is this child to be the legal heir of Naomi, Ruth gives Naomi the child to raise as her own son, to be her son completely. She will raise him, and he will serve her and care for her, not just now, but as she gets older and can't care for herself, and then will be the heir of the land. The storytellers withheld the name of the child to the very end here of the story. And interestingly, the women named the child. Now, that's the only time in the Old Testament you see somebody other than the parents name the children, a child. It just doesn't happen. Parents name the kids. Because, as I've told you before, to name somebody means to have authority over them. But here it's this interesting thing. The women named the child. There's nothing like this. Obed, it means one who serves or servant. So you have names like Obadiah, other places in the Old Testament. Some people will say Obed is shortened form of something else. We don't know. It just says Obed. Probably means that Obed is the one who serves Naomi as guardian redeemer and takes care of her. It's probably what his name's about. Here's the one who will serve you. Here's the one who does serve you. Here's your guardian redeemer. The final surprise in the story for the hearers is the child becomes the father of Jesse, the father of David. So we learn that those in the story who showed sacrificial love are rewarded greatly by Yahweh. Elimelech, I told you in chapter 1, means my God is king. Very significant. Very significant. My God is king. The continuing of Elimelech's name is important. That's what the story is about. How does the name, my God is king, get carried on in the people of Israel? Well, it happens through David. It happens through David. What was the big conflict with Saul? God chooses Saul, but the thing that Saul couldn't get over is Saul thought he was the king. And the difference between him and David was David recognized he wasn't the king, that there was someone else who was the king, that his God was king. And so the importance of the name Elimelech carried along through the family line here, the family line that David inherits, is important. So the point of the author is God divinely ordains the coming of David to the throne. Yahweh had not abandoned Naomi. Chapter 1, she considered Yahweh her enemy, and now Yahweh is the one who's blessing her. It's this thing that just is so difficult for us. When we go through hard times, it's God against us, and then, oh, well, now he's for us. But to say that she gives the son over, that doesn't mean she never sees them, has no interaction, that he doesn't actually spend a lot of his time living with Ruth too, and he just goes and sees grandma on a regular basis. All right? I'm just trying to draw out particular concepts that are here that you might not catch in the first reading. That doesn't mean that, all right, bye, son, I'll never see you again. You get more of that impression in the story of Samuel. Well, here's my child. I'm dumping him off with the priest, never to be seen once a year. Now, that's a harsher story to me to read than they're living in the same town, okay? It's not like they never see each other, even if he lives full time with her, which we don't even know. She's offering to give the child completely to Naomi, and that's the significant part of it here. That doesn't mean that... certainly Naomi can't nurse this baby, all right? So, I mean, a little bit of, you have to imagine this is still family here. It's quite possible. I mean, the words foster mother in the absence of the parents, I'm trying to point out that they're giving the child to him. But that's not to say that they're not spending most of the time raising the child. You can't make these kind of strong things, but I'm just trying to point out there's more there than you probably saw when you just read it through in third grade Sunday school class, okay? You guys trying to make too much of things. Yeah. Oh, it's been done. People have beaten it to death, probably incorrectly. All right. Now, these are the generations of Perez. And we go back to Perez. It's very significant here. The line starts with here. Now, it's customary in genealogies to name 10 names. Okay? So we're going to have 10 names here, but it's not, there's only 10 generations. Obviously, there's more. So, but 10 are listed here. It's customary in genealogies to do special things. Use 10. 5 is a special number, 7 is a special number, and of course the last and the first are special too. So all the names chosen in these particular positions are important. Number 1, Perez. We didn't start with Abraham, we start with Perez. We want to point him out as very important. Because Perez is the son of Tamar and Judah. He fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon's in the fifth spot. He's important. Why is he important? If you look at the people of Israel coming out of Egypt, Nashon is the tribal leader of all of Judah at that point. When the camp sets out, all the Israelites set out, and Judah moves first, Nashon is the head of the tribe, and he goes first. When the tribes are bringing stuff, Nashon represents Judah. In the time of Moses, Nashon is the main man in Israel for Judah and a whole lot more. What else is important about Nashon? He's the brother-in-law to Aaron. Nashon's sister, Elisheba, married Aaron and was the mother of Nadab and Abihu. So this leading man of Judah is married to the family of Moses. No coincidence there, folks. The head people married each other. So Nashon is the uncle to the high priest line of Israel. The high priest kids. So when the tribe set out, Judah and Nashon leads the people in the wilderness. Important guy? Yes. A name we don't think much of? Yeah, because we're not tuned into this kind of stuff. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Name number 7, Boaz. Obviously, he's important. We have this whole story here. He's a special guy. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. The most important guy in the list here. He's the most significant king that Israel ever had. He's the one who founds the most significant dynasty that the people ever had. He's the most significant thing about David is that he understood that Yahweh was the true king of Israel. That's the most important thing about David, that he understood whose God was king. And so you see the connection of Elimelech in chapter 1 leading to David in chapter 4. This is a very, very amazing story. There's a lot of details, a lot of connections, there's a lot of history, a lot of really cool stuff in there. I really am glad I spent a lot of extra time studying that book. Aren't you? Isn't that fun? It's a great, great book.